Story. My name is Justin Patton. I'm senior curator here, and it's a pleasure to have Callum Morton with us. It's the first day of the exhibition called Debuilding, which some of you might have seen, and if you haven't, hope you can after the talk. Callum has a very big work in the show, which, as you may know, is all about what happens behind the scenes in the space between exhibitions that we usually conceal from our audiences. And Callum's work deals with a very common sight behind the scenes at that time, which is artwork crates. And as it happens, the gallery recently, as you probably know, we had the Ron Muick show recently, and we the staff here had to deal with the single biggest art crate that's ever come into the building, which was the box that held a girl, the huge sculpture of the baby. That crate was promptly outsized by Callum's nice. About 2 weeks later, which is pretty sweet going. It's big enough to park a small truck in, but there's not a small truck inside it. There's something else. Callum was just seeing to the something else, and it's all roaring and rumbling away now. Yeah. Callum's a very extremely well-known Australian artist. I won't give you a kind of rundown of the very long CV, but he's someone whose work I first came across when he had a residency at the Govett Brewster in New Plymouth, and you climbed up the staircase at the Govett Brewster and encountered what looked for all the world like three ranch sliders. With their curtains pulled and sort of pressing your ear to those ranch sliders, you heard all kinds of strange and private sounding conversations. And he is an artist who's interested in walls and what goes on behind them, in buildings as containers for, not just for physical things, but feelings and emotions and thoughts and ideas. And more recently, you may have seen an enormous boulder that he appeared to have dropped in a shop on Cashel Street, I think, during the last Scape Urban Art Biennial. And he represented Australia at the Venice Biennale in 2007. So it's great to have you here, Callum, and
thanks,
look
Justin.
Forward to your talk.
Cheers. Are we good to go here? Should that just go on? And that's my talk. Best talk I've ever given. Martin Creed, the UK artist, gave a talk in Melbourne a few years ago to the art school, and he spent the first 20 minutes saying nothing with just a text, a slide behind him. It was unnerving. It was good. Run out of juice, it's on.
Yes.
There we go. Okay, cool. Let's slide.
There you go. Just press it again.
Okay. I've tried to arrange a bit of an order, but it's a little bit, it'll be a bit fluid. So there might be some things I don't really want to talk about, and I'll just wing past them. I gave a talk recently at a private for a private collection in Melbourne. This guy Corbett Lyon and his wife have a big collection of Australian contemporary art, and they live in it. It's called the House Museum. It's a bit like the John Soane Museum or something. And they run talks there, and it's kind of in its infancy. And I titled this talk Inside Out, which was, I thought, a very good way to describe certain areas of my practice, putting things that should be outside inside the gallery and similarly the other way. And as I was trying to break down my work into this kind of stupid taxonomy, I thought of the title Getting Lost, or Get Lost, which is a bit more accurate in a sense, because as a general feeling, that's what I want the audience to feel in these kind of tiny moments of disbelief, perhaps, when they encounter some of my work. And I guess a lot of this has its origins in the early days for me with the Situationists, which is why I always show this image. And the Situationists, if you don't know, were a group of radical artists and writers and, in Paris. They started as the Lettres in the 50s and evolved in the mid to late 60s into this very influential arm. And we're deeply involved in, I guess, the seminal moment of May 68 politics and all that sort of stuff. And less interested in that than their particular methods for what they called reactivating the ambience of the city. That, you know, their criticism is that we live our lives going from A to B and we don't look anywhere else. And every day we go down those kind of familiar pathways. And so this idea of rediscovering a kind of poetics. Their avatar, I guess, was Guy Debord, who was the main thinker and wrote a famous book called The Society of the Spectacle. And one of their methods was this thing called, it's basically the drift. So they use kind of these detourne, they call these cut-up maps, where they'll take a map of... it's a kind of familiar strategy that has been played out, you know, over the years, but take a map of Berlin and walk through Paris, you know, using that map, or a map from elsewhere, or cut up the city of Paris and reassemble it and have to follow that. And in their mind, it was a way of discovering, nominating particular sites as psychogeographic. But for me, this idea that they willfully got lost in the city and they willfully wanted to keep alive the poetics of the city was important. And I think it's particularly pertinent with somewhere like Christchurch at the moment, because after the earthquake, since I haven't been here for a few years, there are holes in the city fabric. And, I went for a run the other morning and I kind of got lost. And I was looking for a few sort of landmarks, and there's lots of, you know, fencing up and you're going the wrong way. And that sense of disorientation is, I think, can be a moment of enlightenment, I guess. I began doing my own versions of this, of taking my local train station and renaming it. So this relationship between, you know, the text and some kind of image, or and breaking that connection. And so the idea that you're travelling home and you get out at the station and the name's different, and so... So it's exploring, I guess, a sort of paranoia of space as well. And it also began with these drawings of, modernist commission for public housing projects and redoing the facade. So an idea of reinvention of a kind of facade. And I was interested in the German philosopher Walter Benjamin, who... his thinking is described as seeing the city as the street as a room, the street, the walls of the building as the interior of a room, and this idea of oppositions kind of reverting or at play or contradicting each other kind of emerged really early in this time. So I, this is in 1994 at the Archive of New South Wales, a work called Belvedere. So I began making these in that way. I was driving for a job, you know, so the street became, a sort of site of research for me. And so this idea of taking something from the world, cutting it out, and grafting it onto the interior of the museum. So a play between inside and outside, very literal, very simple. Also, this idea of how you perceive the world at speed, travelling in a car. So you perceive the world out of the corner of your eyes and specific places collapse into these generic ones, if you like. So I call these works generic in that sense. And they're pitched at three-quarter scale. So I was playing with scale very early on. It was very self-conscious, if you like, to set up these, you know, oppositions between inside and outside, the model and the real, interior, exterior, reality and illusion. And so I was approximating something like production design or in theatre or film, but as well kind of negotiating kind of sculpture. And so these are pitched at three-quarter scale, so they're just below, you know, actual size. And you can see the illusion of this from the balcony above. I did a number of it was in this well space, and you could get up top and look down and see the exposed wood, etc. A work called The Heights, 1995. This was my first show in a commercial gallery, and which I was pretty reluctant about, I must say, at the time. And so here in this corner, this window is kind of cut off. So it's this sense of a faux urban archaeology at work that, you know, was this here, you know, and the gallery built around it, or, you know, I thought of it as a kind of reluctant object, you know, that was kind of trying to get out. But it's called The Height. So there's kind of a irony in the titles, of course, and that's me wearing a suit, yeah. Back in the day. This was at ArtSpace in Auckland, in 1997. So that, and this happens a lot with the work, that things reappear. There's not a clear, smooth chronology. You know, there's a kind of body of ideas that I circulate around, and I go back and forth between them. And new developments happen, but I sort of pour them back in. So these balconies have reappeared again and again over the time. Similarly, you know, I guess work that's kind of collapsed together that is a graft onto the museum, same thing, taking the outside and putting it in inside the new museum, again at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. It's not like the only place I show at, but a work called Motormouth. And I had introduced sound into the work at this stage, and so there is a narrative here of a road rage incident. This is at 1 to 10, so I went from three-quarter scale, which... And that three-quarter scale was really about... I kind of stumbled across it, really. But, you know, 5/8, three-quarter, there's the scales of kind of cinema. If you go to Universal Studios in Los Angeles, a lot of the doorways are kind of pitched that scale to make the actors in the foreground seem bigger, and there are these various kind of scalar devices in film and theatre, of course. And so that's at 1 to 10, which is, you know... Doll's House scale is 1 to 12. So the idea of shifting and finding, scales is important. It's as if someone's living under the thing. So it says Obama and, a few things, a bit of graffiti. And this is, you know, fairly recent work called Monument Number 21, I think, Slump, which is, and I must say, if you're interested in, they're made out of polystyrene that are then coated with resin or polyurethane. This work, Slump, from 2009, I think, in a commercial gallery, and one side of the wall is slumping impossibly, a breeze block wall, and the other side, that's propped up, and this is your entrance to the gallery. So it's this idea that it's kind of, this scale's kind of imposing. And the other side is a painted mural, a geometry taken from a Le Corbusier building in Chandigarh, in fact, the kind of geometry. And so that geometry is falling away. And I wanted it to be painted... it looks quite good, but it's quite rough when you see it. And the falling away, extends the geometry. It does something with that. But this idea, again, that there are two sides. Quite literally, it's a kind of dialectics of thought between, you know, two skins of something. And the work, it plays out in the work here, of course. There's an interior and an exterior, or an outside and inside, or et cetera, et cetera. Another work that was in the show, an impossibly curved wall that's propped up. These are all works I sort of put in this idea of taking the outside and putting it in. This was a work from last year called Monument Number 22, Settlement, which is a homeless shelter, but it's all cast in resin. So it looks like the real thing. And so I suppose that moment that I'm talking about where you are not sure what to think. You either walk past it. Justin was talking about that work at the Govett Brewster, which I don't have an image of, unfortunately, but I do have another one from a work they own. And when the work was being blessed in the morning during the Māori ceremony, you know, and they go around and bless all the works, when they they just completely walked past my windows, which was a kind of a compliment, you know, that it was kind of doing what it was meant to do, I suppose. And similarly, this work, it was overlooked on a number of occasions. Whether that's interesting or not, and the kind of play of simulation, but I saw it as a kind of sarcophagus for my own body too, if you like. And, you know, if you look at a batch of my work, it does negotiate some idea of the dwelling or the house or something, from caves to, you know, high modernist architecture to my own home, my family home, etc. So it felt like another one of those. I'll just skip these. These are basically linked to that idea of... I did a series of prints where I took iconic modernist houses and I grafted onto them commercial franchises, if you like. So it's taking the private and making it public, or problematizing that relationship between the public and the private. And in fact, I started at a certain point with this series of oppositions, and the public and the private, the relationship between the public and private, and the contest for that is one of the ones that's stuck quite strongly. And I think it's to do with the fact that outside of the kind of discourse of the public and private, for me, simply someone doing something strange in the public realm and how that can make everyone uncomfortable has always been a kind of fascinating thing for me, that conflict or violence can create paranoia, fear, and make you less comfortable in the world. You know, it's something that I find fascinating. Don't ask me why. Anyway, so I guess I was being a bit violent on these structures too. But and with this work, I rang McDonald's and I said, "This is a Sidler House in Australia, which is, I guess, the first." Or one of the first modernist houses in that kind of high or international style modernity. Harry Sidler had trained with Marcel Breuer and came out as a kind of emigre to Australia, and he built this house for his mother. And so I rang McDonald's and I said, you know, can you, your in-house team, redesign this building for me? And they were going to do it. It was really for a particular context. There was a magazine article and I wanted this image to be part of that article. And they said no, so I did it. But then I kind of launched into this whole series of these virtual constructions of the world and that I make in the computer from the ground up. And I guess there's a kind of constellation of them now. And it's very important, this idea of the virtual and how that has come out of the computer into the world. So in many senses, you know, I've often thought that I was constructing Callum's world, you know, a place you'd kind of, a theme park you'd go to. some of these works that I'll show you do look like, and even this one here, do look like, you know, a kind of virtual image rather than a real one. And I don't know if that's because I've looked at the computer too much, but I won't go into these works. There's very specific kind of this capital complex that Le Corbusier and Chandigarh, but they're sort of epic. This is the Australian Pavilion at Venice that I redid for a particular thing. And then similarly, there are works where I've flipped it and taken the commercial franchise. So this is a Beau Repairs, which is a tire outlet in Australia, and I turned it into an apartment block. And this is a Pizza Hut that I doubled it, mirrored it, and turned it into a, you know, a two-story house. And performing the same function as this is this work in the Pines. Was part of a Biennale in Victoria with the Tarawarra Biennale. You know, he's not talking. That's amazing. Is that just Christchurch? Is that a Christchurch thing? I'll just wait for him. You done? Okay, cool. No, you're right. That's fine. I, for the Biennale, Le Pine is a famous funeral service provider in Victoria, and so I had to get their permission, but I made a version of their sign, a copy of their sign, that was on the road on the way up to the museum. And so it really is what I was talking about, that kind of virtual thing, escaping from the computer into the world, or trying to flip the world in a way, and that the prints were doing, all those models, etc. A number of people did turn around and think they weren't at the museum. They thought they were at Lapine, and it was to do with this building here. It's kind of shaped like an arc. That's not a good image of it, but it's shaped like an arc, and you know, it was a sense that it was a church, and I wanted to turn it into a church and put a big cross on it. And the people that owned the museum wouldn't let me do it for various reasons. And the kind of negotiation went from the church to Lapine, anyway. On the side of a freeway in Melbourne called the Eastlink Freeway, I was commissioned to do this hotel, which is, again, illuminates that idea of the virtual escaping the computer. And this really does look like a cartoon of a hotel. You know, this negotiation, public art is a very difficult beast to negotiate, and for me, and I don't particularly like it, in the form that we know it, I suppose. It's like a catalogue of, you know, the trash of the future. So for me, I was interested in doing something that might otherwise appear on the side of the road, so a piece of roadside architecture, if you like. It's still diminutive, it's about two-thirds in scale. It's 20 metres high, 10 metres across, and 5 metres wide, so impossibly thin, too, or deep. And there's 12 windows that, I don't have a photo of it, but at night, at dusk, all 12 come on and they go off, you know, 1 hour until the wee hour. So it's a sort of sad, pathetic little hotel, much like, I guess, those, I don't know if you have them here, those Formula One hotels or something. These kind of generic, you know, hotels you see near the airport or something. You know, it's achieved a certain form of, I'm not going to say notoriety, but there's a kind of odd form of tenderness around this work for the general public. And it's a strange thing about public art. When you do it, it's not your work anymore. It's something, you know, it has other narratives attached to it. It's been smashed a number of times, you know, paint bombed in the first week. There's an internal staircase to get up to these solar panels in the roof, and kids have been caught on CCTV just running up trying to smash windows, and it's got an infestation of redback spiders, which is quite a dangerous little spider in there. And so they're running around in the dark with redback spiders amongst all this glass, you know, this kind of open staircase. So, I mean, now it's kind of got steel on it downstairs and down in these windows here, so they can't get in, painted black steel. They put a Santa on top of it without asking me over Christmas. And people text me, you know, they go, well, hey, have you seen the Santa on your hotel? Because it's on the way down to the beach, so you have to be going that way all the time to see it. Anyway.
What colours did they paint it?
When they paint bombed it?
Yeah.
Well, actually, they threw paint and it got up to here. So they, you know, which is about, that's pretty high. And I said to them, well, we'll just leave it. You know, this idea that it, you know, that like a building it would grow and decay, you know, rather than being polished. And they were really uncomfortable with that idea. But they've since accepted that that's what will happen in the future, that it just, you know, apart from, you know, fixing things that will kill people, any damage like that, you know, any paint or anything just remains on it. Now I'm getting to the shops. This is similar. This is an earlier work in Sydney at an artist-run space called CBD in about 1996. And I went up to the space and I walked around the area, and there is a locksmith, John Farrell locksmith, exactly the same, you know, one street away. So I just copied it and put it on to CBD and closed the gallery. But so, you know, again, people would come and, you know, they wouldn't be sure if the gallery had disappeared. So it's performing a kind of that erasure or hole or something that's created, or that sort of performing a kind of illusion of disappearance. I mean, I think it's a kind of micro shock or something. In Warsaw, I did another shop where, you know, I was invited into a show in Warsaw in Poland, and I remade a Polish restaurant that used to be, in my local street that we all used to go to as at art school, called Helen's Polish Kitchen. And this is an old suite of shops that the museum found, and I remade the menu as I could remember it, and you could go in and you could actually have a coffee and have this pierogi and what have you. And I've always done the shop window thing, so this relationship to, I guess, I'll talk about it more. Anyway, in Istanbul, I was invited into a show. And look, you can just ask questions as we go. I'm kind of running through it. So if you want me to talk about something, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I saw it there, and I thought, I know this image, and I just saw the, this newspaper thing called Blog 6.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Do you remember even putting something like an image into a blog magazine or physics
magazine? No, that's not me. But actually, I would say that Log would be across those kind of ideas. For sure. So that's a good pickup. And so in Istanbul, the Naked City thing, I guess, is kind of hovering over this a bit. I was invited into a show called The Pedestrian, which was happening at the same time as the Istanbul Biennial. It's a kind of adjunct show, is how I kind of understood it. And it was concentrated in a couple of areas. But the first incarnation of the show was happening every 2 years at that stage, doesn't go anymore, was in a kind of shopping district. So this one was in this area, this kind of park, alongside the Bosphorus, that a lot of street kids hung out in. And I saw this building and, I'm not working in the chronology here, and I'll kind of go back to how sort of certain things evolved, but the kids used to hide their, glue and drugs in there and stuff like that. And I wanted to use that as a site. So what I did was I got Levi to sponsor me to make a brand new shop over the... This is in 2006 or 7. A brand new shop over and just leave the rubble in there. So there's a glass door. And then it's illuminated at night. So this area, and you can see what I first show you, this is kind of, it's a hardware district. So these people, that's a roll door, goes up and there's a shop in there, and all through this kind of decaying, series of arcades are these little hole in the wall, hardware stores. It's an amazing area. And but I guess for them, the whole deal was that this is an area up for development, and that's the contest over this site, that is public, that is going to be made private, which is why they chose me, to be in it. Another shop, and I guess this is part of the evolution of the Cashel Street Workforscape, that I called Sexy Monument Number. I can't remember my monument numbers, but Sexy Beast. I don't know if you know this film, but it's got a called Sexy Beast, and it's got a great opening sequence with Ray Winston in the Spanish sun, shaving himself by the pool, and it's kind of, I think it's in silence, and this boulder is released from up there and it's heading straight towards him, and then at the last minute it jumps over his head and lands in the pool, and so for the first 15 minutes there's a boulder in the pool. And that stayed with me ever since I'd seen that film. And so in Cashel Street, I came over and we carved this rock out of polystyrene inside the space that is illuminated at night. So it's as if it's, to me there's a narrative about, something coming from outside. So this, relationship between the inside and the outside, but this outside is outer space, if you like. And so to continue the kind of rock theme from an earlier work, which changes things a little bit and announces... other work. This is a work called Babylonia at the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art in Melbourne in 2005. And It is an it's a basically a carved island out of polystyrene, based on the island in called Lisca Bianca in Antonioni's La Ventura, and there is often, you know, specific kind of references. And I suppose I talked about that generic thing in the beginning with the balconies, and how that stuff is gleaned from a kind of range of sources, and everything sort of collapsed into each other. And it did relate quite clearly to the fact that I had this job driving around, and I was anxious about not having enough time to make work, and I made the side of the car a side of research. And the side of the car is this weird thing where, you know, you're outside in the world, but you're inside the car, but everyone can see you, and so the relationship between the public and the private is kind of confused, and the roads are kind of non-place, and non-place is, I guess, a new kind of distinction, or not new now, of kind of urban archaeology, if you like, where there are places like airports and cinemas and stadiums that are really about how you move through them, and they encourage you to move through them, not to occupy them. So they kind of exist between these spheres. and so this idea of kind of, once I stopped that job, I started looking, I suppose, between, or wanting to combine the idea of the generic with the specific, or the local and general, those kind of things. And so anyway, the source will start as specific. In this case, it does, if that makes sense. So it just sits in the kind of black sea floor of the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art. And then there's a little portal here. And you go inside, and there's this hotel corridor that's got you know, a mirror at either end, so there's kind of infinite space. And the corridor is taken from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. I'll run through some of it. You know, so clearly there is the, you know, the kind of form of the theme park. I've been living in Los Angeles, and this, you know, attraction to badly carved rocks. And but also, I think, say, at Disneyland, the ride, the Pirates of the Caribbean, I've often said it, is, I don't know if you've ever been there, but the, one of the first rides Disney ever made is a little, you know, you go in a boat and you're down a kind of canal through the kind of swamplands, and then you're plunged into the underbelly of Disney, and this huge space kind of opens up, and it's an extraordinary experience of kind of immersion in spatial terms, and the effect of kind of illusion, a complete experience. Anyway, so it was as much about research as taking my kids, but, you know. it used to be like, well, let's go to Disney again. And so I was looking at that, and I was looking at, you know, other sources, the Isle of the Dead, Arnold Berkeley. This, you know, at the time, clearly there was post 9/11, and this idea of, you know, the kind of the other, you know, occupying that territory out there. You know, so often with, you know, the soundtracks, you know, they really are kind of messy, more uncomfortable space alongside the kind of generic one. You know, you travel through the world, through airports, through non-places, and you're comfortable. Well, I mean, you know, things are kind of destabilised, but you're generally comfortable, and you might go to sort of an airport in a third world country, and you can remain outside outside of experiencing the kind of stuff out there. That makes sense. Zoo architecture, and then I took photos of hotels, and I've got a lot of photos of hotel corridors for years. And this is The Shining. I couldn't get the carpet, but got the doors and everything else. And so The Shining is a kind of, you know, this series of labyrinths that, you know, the final denouement in the maze. But this is an image from La Ventura, where, I don't know if you know it, but he lives in this on the island. Has anyone seen La Ventura? Okay, well, it's a film. The reason why I like that film is it's a film where the central character disappears in the first 15 minutes, and they spend the rest of the time trying to find this hole in the film. So, you know, this couple and the woman's friend go on a holiday, and she disappears on this island, and they can't find her. And so this kind of unexplained sort of thing. It made a kind of big impression on me. So again, it's a kind of hole or a kind of erasure. Anyway, on this island, there's this thing they made, and a guy lives in it, and he's talking about how his brother runs this cafe in Melbourne, you know, which is, you know, there we go. And I connected that to Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is a Australian film, and disappearance of these girls. This is fiction. So there's a work called Grotto, which I did, was completed a couple of years ago. And so I'm just following the rock theme, if you like. How am I going for time? Well, I'm doing fine, but what's...
How far through
your slides are you? Oh, just tell me how much time I've got, I reckon.
Everyone happy?
Yep. We're all good? Okay, yeah, all right. Slowing down. Okay. So I made a work for Venice, which I'll show in a minute, but I was invited to do a work in the Netherlands in a place called Tilburg, and there is a sculpture, or there's an art organisation there called the Fundament, who do a show of outside work every 4 years, a bit like a kind of Munster or that kind of tradition. And they were looking to get some sort of purchase in the garden, and they wanted a cafe and a bar, as well as a ticket office and toilets for that event. So they invited me to make a work. They'd seen these works like Babylonia or other ones where you walk in and there is a space that you kind of occupy outside, and they thought, oh, hey, he can do architecture. But I worked with a local architect. So it's a black mirror box, Mesian black mirror box, with a kind of outside garden, outside, seating area. And then at night, it has these kind of three conditions. So I'm describing, you know, an inside and an outside. And I was kind of interested in this idea of the work having three states. So in the space between the glass and where the lights are, there is a sculpted, you know, brain that you can only see at night. And you descend down into it, and inside there's a kind of this carved grotto. This is a kitchen area, a toilet here, seating, etc. I thought of it like a kind of tomb as well. And I think for me, there's often it's a bit like deathly humour in some of my work. I can't quite find the phrase right now. I'm sure Justin would have it in his head. But so this idea of it being kind of a tomb, and that people go in and they're going down into the crypt, you know, but it's also a place where you eat and etc. But then, of course, you know, of course, this sort of this garden, and it's a Baroque garden. So that was kind of the context too. It's quite unusual for there to be a Baroque garden that in the Netherlands, of course, because it's quite far south, it's near Belgium. So there is this kind of hangover, and they didn't know it was a Baroque garden until the 70s. It's just a kind of, it's a crazy wood, really, sort of overgrown, and a landscape architect plotted it out and kind of, and they cleared it. So it has this very defined geometry of a kind of, you know, circle in one quadrant, you know, triangle, square, etc., and the radiating. Mm.
Sorry, to interrupt again, but I've seen all of your sculptures, but as well as the sexy beast and escape, I also realised there was another work called Better Tap Tap. Is there anything about that you can explain?
The sound work.
Yeah.
It was just a sound work in the car park. Mm-hmm. That was an edited sound piece of a kind of like ghosts going up and down the stairs, effectively, and walking around the car park. So it was that was it. Nothing there.
Was it just like a one-shot idea of doing the sound work, or was it like part of a series of sound works?
Yeah, I don't really do sound works, but there is. It's a good question, because there is this idea that with the sounds, it happens here too, that, you know, the sound becomes disembodied from the work and becomes another work. So here the cat meows through the space, and you don't really know what's there until you get inside it. So, you know, talking about those, you know, things being erased or no, you're right. And so... that's great. I should take a photo of this.
Oh, God.
That's great. Okay, this is my next talk. Thanks very much. So this work is in the centre of the garden as well. So there's this Baroque geometry, and all the paths, you know, meet at this centre. This is the centre of this park. So the idea of kind of mirroring it is that, you know, the path, the black was because it was against the wood. So I was trying to do something that was disappear, that again, something that was invisible, and that the paths at certain vantage points look like they continue on. So I was kind of playing with that geometry, if you like. It doesn't, you know, work 100% because they made me move, you know, 5 metres right because of, you know, something anyway. But there you go. Pardon?
Is it still active?
Oh, actually, it's permanent. So, well, it's 5 years, and at the opening there was the Friends of the Grotto was founded, and there. So I guess, and it is popular. Well, it was. I don't know. I haven't spoken to them for a while, and there's a book coming out on it next year. But they. So I think its popularity will determine how long it exists for after the 5 years. I mean, certainly it was made to survive. I mean, it's a building, and I work with architects to do that. But, you know, it is polystyrene, it's coated, you know, and so I'd be interested to see how it holds up after that time.
Did you dictate what sort of food you were there to serve there?
No. I just provided a frame, you know, basically. I mean, you know, I planned it, you know. I did, you know, do the architecture on it, if you like. There was a local furniture guy who made these, which are very nice. These kind of Rietveld-esque, ply furniture. That's a kind of frame. So there was this thing about, you know, not having the, columns in, you know, obstructing the view. And so they devised this thing, which was pretty good, I thought, which is a nice, segue into this work, though I might, unfortunately, well, I've done a series of work on the Farnsworth House. It's kind of a bit of a long story, a Mies van der Rohe house, and I can maybe come back to it inside the conversation about that work, which is a famous house that Mies van der Rohe designed in between 48 and 51. It was the first glass house. You know, it was before Philip Johnson's glass house. Even though his was built earlier, he'd seen Mies van der Rohe's drawings. And I had made a work called Cellar, which was the cellar from Nightmare of the Living Dead in a gallery with a sensor. And it relates, I wanted to show it because it does clearly relate to this work. And it's got a sensor, and when you trigger it, a motor goes off and the sound of the beast and the chains rattle and the green lines. It's a completely theatrical work. And I was really interested in how theatrical could you go with the work, using the kind of language of production design, and sort of retain some sense of objectness, if that makes sense. Anyway, so I made the Farnsworth House directly after that. So in terms of the sequence, you know, I chose the Farnsworth House because it was a particular time where, I guess, post-modernity had shifted back to a type of neo-modernity, and in terms of, you know, a kind of aesthetics of the time. This was the most, you know, the Farnsworth House was, you know, I guess, sort of the most beautiful container I could imagine. So it was going from the kind of kitsch container to the most beautiful one. And in my work, and I did a number of versions of it, there's a 1 to 12 version, which is 1 to 10 actually, which is, it has a cycle of a party sequence with Christmas lights, and then at a certain point a woman screams, "Don't you dare touch me." And five gunshots go off and everyone's screaming, and then the screams go on, and then it just dies down, and then it starts again. So, and it just goes on interminably. So the loop of the soundtrack is a really important part of it, because it's very much about this idea of the messy stuff in the suburbs that goes on outside there, you know, and here's this object immured and its discipline, you know, at the kind of centre of things. And so connecting, you know, the peripheral and the central, you know. So the loop, this idea of something's not buried, it will continue to return. So this idea, the eternal return. And I did a number of versions of it. There's one at the Santa Monica Museum in Los Angeles, which is at 1 to 5. So it's as if it, the closer, it's in Plano, Illinois. So like the closer it got to the site of origin, it's been squeezed through a portal and getting bigger. Then I made 4, like I made a compound of them. So there's the party sequence. There's a burglary going on there with a torch. There's nothing going on here. And there's a film about the end of the world there from the same year that they were made. You know, then I did a print of it as a, you know, 7-Eleven, because in a sense it announces it announces a kind of connection to, you know, that type of design. I might just skip to.
Callum, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
There's a really cheeky sense of humour in a lot of your work, and I just wonder, you know, when you're talking about those crossovers between private and public. Are you censoring yourself at any point? Like, how cheeky do you want to be, and have you fully realised that? Can you in some of those works?
Censor myself?
Yeah, censoring yourself.
I mean, I think everyone censors themselves in terms of what's permissible and what isn't, or what I think, how far you want to go one way and whether it outweighs the kind of balance another way. It's a good question, actually. Because I guess sometimes you want to go extreme, you know, and sometimes you don't. But that's one way of answering the question. But it's a tough question, actually. I'm not sure.
I just wonder if that's something that you privately, as that artist, when you're in those moments, if sometimes you do have to feel that sort of that reining back due to it becoming sort of a public concern as opposed to.
Oh, you mean for the outside work, you mean? Okay, that people use on a daily basis as opposed to the context of the museum where you're allowed to kind of do more things. But there's also, yeah, sure. I mean, I haven't done, you know, an outside work that's got all the kind of bells and whistles. And often it's because, how do you maintain something like that if it's a permanent work, you know? And that's one of the great benefits of doing temporary outside works, because it does allow you, you know, to play with a lot more, you know, and if they want to shut it down, they will, they can. If that answers the question. But
does that humour translate? I mean, you're working on an international scale. Do you notice different?
Well, I think it's you know, like Hitchcock said, I love a bit of violence. It's a kind of it's a sort of sense of humour around that subject, and the humour, I guess, affords you the capacity to talk about maybe some difficult things. Is how I think of it. But also, I like comedy, you know, and I don't. You know, I am really a child of my era in that sense, that I like the idea of everything being included. You know, that it's not, you know, it's not high and low, you know, inside and out. All that stuff is about taking as many things and putting it all into the pot and seeing what comes out. And sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes it does. But, you know, I like, you know, a pile of dirt, you know, a crappy awning as much as I like, you know, you know, Aretha Angus, you know, I wish I could kind of include it all, but, and, you know, I'm pegged one way, but in fact my reach of what I'm interested in, I reckon, is pretty broad. And that's not just because I want it all, though. There always is a sense that you're going to lose something, you know, when you make a choice, you know, but I guess that's another question. This is a work called Gas and Fuel, which the Gas and Fuel buildings in Melbourne was kind of, you know, at the time a sort of celebrated version of late international style modernity that were ripped down to make, and I haven't got a picture of it, a new museum in the kind of Liebskin mode, if you know that, called Federation Square. I don't know if some of you have been to Melbourne, but I'm sure you know. And in fact, you know, Gas and Fuel had all the kind of euphoria attached to it when it opened, and there was a whole plan to design the precinct and open up a square, and, you know, it was just the shift in kind of style, but at the end it was the most hated building in Melbourne. So just when Federation Square opened, I did a show at Anna Schwartz Gallery in Melbourne, which is just next to the NGV, just kind of up the road, and I scaled the work to 1 to 34, which is the number of years it was alive for, so I anthropomorphised the building, and I took a soundtrack from The Fly, the original Fly, a film of the same era, and it was really just my voice that was distorted, and it said, "Help me, please help me." So these buildings are stuck in the tomb of the gallery. This is really a kind of tomb, this gallery. and they're saying, help me, please help me, as if it's, you know, been disappeared and reappeared and doesn't know where it is. So it's a kind of little building lost, if you like. And the beauty of this work is that it ended up back in Federation Square because the owner, the person who bought it and he donated it to the work, was Corbett Lyon, who I talked about earlier, has this house museum, and his dad designed this building. So, you know, it sits in, when it's out, it sits in this this antechamber between galleries, if you like. And and the, you know, the idea of the kind of disembodied sound is, you know, they, in this space, the sound bounces, you know, kind of radically through the space. And new guards and some old people have been looking for this little child that's lost at the end of the night. That's true, you know. And so the sound is completely disembodied, you know, when it's on. So I would go in when it was on. It was up for quite a while. And they'd keep turning down the soundtrack, you know, so that to the point that it was inaudible. And without the sound, it kind of did remind me that without the sound, it just becomes a commemorative model. You know, it doesn't do anything. You know, so the sound is everything in that sense. So I would go in and just turn it up and walk away. I mean, it's just there. You just pick it up and turn it up and walk away, and then, you know, you come back and they would have. And one day when I was there checking it, a group of school kids came in and with a teacher giving a tour, and she sat them all down, and I was here. And just trying to hear the sound. And then she started giving this very enthusiastic talk about, oh, you know, there's, you know, what do you think this is? And this was the building that used to be here. She's very, you know, engaged in the whole story. And then she grabbed one of the students and said, now go over there and can you hear the soundtrack? And he came and stood right next to me. And I said, look, I don't think there is any sound. And she looked at me and she said, no, there is. And I said, yeah, but it's not very loud. And she said, well, it's low for a reason, and if you hang around, I'll tell you why. And I remember it was like one of those moments where you go, but I didn't, because she was so enthusiastic, I felt like it would have been pretty pretty unfair of me. But anyway, that's a story.
Is sound an integral part of the work that you're currently doing?
Yeah, it's part of it. Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. Oh, you mean generally what I'm doing? No. I'm just really showing you work that does that in a way that kind of relates to the work. And there are lots of other works I do that have no sound. I mean, not having sound is a kind of relief. I've got images of stuff there I'm happy to show, but I think I can't do the sound things all the time. You know, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've just done it a lot, and, you know, sometimes it gets a bit boring or something. But yeah, it has been an integral part of what I described before as of describing a kind of figuration or something like that, or kind of presence, you know.
And so for your process, is it always evident from the beginning of the painting of a wood that it needs a soundtrack for you, or is that something that emerges as you keep moving?
Yeah, that's a good question. The sound is always there, you know. Sometimes the sound's there before the work, you know. Sometimes the sound would be just... I mean, I'm not a sound artist, you know. I know lots of sound artists, you know, who spend a lot of time with this stuff, and I'm really like, you know, all thumbs on the computer, editing some crappy soundtrack that I get from somewhere and repaste it, and, you know, I mean, that's kind of what I do. I try and tell some sort of narrative. So I guess the narrative's kind of announced in my head, and I discover things along the way, but I very rarely do sound on its own. I've done a work, you know, here, but I did a work in an old abandoned building that a group of artists did, and I just had this recording of these, actually from this work, Habitat, which was a 1:50 scale model of a building that my father had worked on, who was an architect, that has 24 soundtracks and lights running through it, and it's a sped up day in the life of this building. And there's one where these two guys are arguing, and this, you know, couple's arguing, and I took that soundtrack and I put it inside that room. So I did it for this, but then it was, you know, I used it independently and locked the door. And it did really sound like this couple were having an argument in this kind of little room. And but I'm not really going to talk about this. This is a kind of, you know, panoramic, this day in the life. The sun comes up, sun comes down, and you view the work from this. In the NGV, it had, you know, portals where you could look down and see the lights, which, you know, and it's a day sort of sped up. And this building in particular, you know, there was a kind of Oedipal drama that it was, you know, a building my father had worked on, and I was born in Montreal, and that's why he was there working for this architect called Moshe Safdie. And Safdie had, this was his Yale thesis, you know, his master's thesis, this building, and was commissioned to do this this building called Habitat. And, you know, it was kind of a prototype, if you like, and a realisation of a lot of work that architects were doing in particular at that time, using kind of modular architecture. Archigram, Cedric Price, Yona Friedman, these kind of people that all kind of existed as sort of speculation, as theoretical architecture. He kind of realised this sort of plug-in thing, and it was a disaster financially. They cast it all on site, you know, they screwed up the foundations, and it fell into this kind of dystopian ruin for years. And then it's been revived with that kind of surge of neo-modernity that I was talking about, you know, as kind of luxury apartments.
So that thing's a real building?
Yeah, this is a real building, yeah, yeah. In fact, it's got a back on it. I cut the back off for the sake of this thing, but it's got a back. Yeah, it's still there. And, you know, on this, I think it's called Ile de la Cité in Montreal, there's the Buckminster Fuller Geodesic Dome, and it was part of World Expo 67. And I'm particularly interested in the expo, if you know, the history of expos, you know, alongside the theme park as kind of, you know, modes of spectacle. Or anyway, but I'll just finish here. I'm sorry to go on a bit, but the work I did for Venice, which called Valhalla, which was based on, which was a copy, in fact, of the family home that my dad designed that we lived in. And the reason I chose to do it, I mean, you know, of course I have hinted at a kind of Oedipal connection between things, and so the personal getting mixed up with the private, it kind of gets back to that idea of kind of tipping everything in. But I suppose the idea of the personal, it's kind of a tough one to negotiate, because you can't really grapple with other ideas if everyone just focuses on, you know, your story, particularly for something like Venice. I'm not saying I regretted it, but I mean it's one part of it. But I chose it because when I went to, for Venice, you have these kind of fundraising functions, and I actually went to, you know, one, and on the way home, I drove past this building and it had been knocked down. So this idea of kind of an erasure, a hole that I started the talk with, you know, related to here and, you know, the Naked City, you know, it was a kind of, you know, a particularly compelling kind of hole, if you like, for me. So I decided to bring it back from the dead, and ship it across the world. So it was unfinished. You know, it's a kind of classic sort of architect story. Ran out of money. Eventually had to sell the house because he overcommitted money to it. But it was during my teenage years, so I suppose it had this. Of course, it had this sort of emotional significance. So I remade it at 3/4 scale, and we in fragments, and we shipped it, you know, in 2 40-foot containers to Venice, and rebuilt it on this old Armenian soccer pitch inside this old Armenian school. Outside of in Venice, you have the Giardini, which is the central kind of focus where the pavilions are, and, you know, increasingly over the years they've been kind of outside projects, and I suppose Australia really ratcheted up their kind of presence there that year with 3 projects. One, Daniel von Stumer, a New Zealand artist, actually, in the pavilion, and then 2 projects, Susan Norrie and mine, outside. It's suitably kind of weathered and aged. So it's this idea of, on the one hand, there's this, personal image of something returning, of a building that's returns from the dead, but it returns shot through with holes, you know, as the dead tend to do, but it looks like a kind of media image. It's all boarded up, abandoned, a bit like Gas and Fuel, I suppose, that kind of connection of it being a bit, sorry. Babylonia in the sequence, the island, is the work, you know, one of the works before then. So there's this, I guess it's a question of, you know, economies, but there was this interest in entering, you know, back to the, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, this kind of immersion inside a work So it has a number of states. So this is the work before the grotto, and they saw this work, and this is how the grotto came about, really, that and Istanbul. So it's just doing work in Europe. So it has smoke coming out of it. You know, I copied tags from, you know, around the area, which is a real no-no, but I did. So at night it has this kind of outside condition which the light pours through these holes with smoke, so it's very theatrical in that sense. That's the party with it kind of going off. It's a kind of great ironic image. And then inside there's an entrance on each side, and inside there's this corporate lobby, and this is all at three-quarter scale, and there is a gatekeeper, if you like, who sits there and was directed to say nothing and ignore everyone as if they weren't there. So, in a sense, it kind of rendering anyone who participated in it as a kind of ghost. They can press the button and they all sit there waiting, and then it calls the lifts, and, you know, they thunder this old kind of mechanics, and they thunder sort of there, and then it dings, and it kind of hovers there before plunging away, but the machinery is just kind of going. But it's amazing. It's you know, someone described it critically as boring because nothing happens. And to me, that's the kind of anti-theme park. You know, it's like it's this immersive. Right on this point here, there's that shift between the two spaces, and you get that kind of, you know, sense of wonder or something. But then you expect something to happen, but it's kind of been removed. And so the doors, the things behind the doors, or things you can't quite get to, or leaving something out, that's all very important to me, that, you know, that kind of, you know, nothing happens. Yeah, anyway, so this gatekeeper, if you like, would... did I say innkeeper before? A gatekeeper would mop the floors, and then there'd be times when they weren't there. I mean, there were actors from the local, you know, drama school. Now I'm happy to go. Hang on, not going to do that. Not going to do that. Not going to do that. I can just go. So you know, works without sound. You know, I made these kind of monuments and screens over the last, and this kind of exists alongside what I do. And it certainly relates, the smaller works relate to the bigger ones, and they're kind of, it's like sort of drawing or something, but they're not, they're objects unto themselves. And so I've done it, you know, there was a specific project where I used the drive-in screen, and it's a, I guess, this idea of a kind of outmoded form of entertainment that persists in some weird way. So I kind of object, if you like. And so I do a number of versions of you know, this is the Saul Bass's design for the blob, when I've taken out, removed the text, and they're, you know, one with thousands of bullet holes in it, charred. So they're kind of the anti-image or something, if you like, charred and torched, taking posters and repainting them in 3D and raising paint splattered. And then these smaller monuments, but I won't, I'm repeating things, but I won't go there. Is there anything else? Is there a work there you saw you wanted me to talk about? Yep.
Can I be greedy and ask you two questions?
Yeah, go for it.
Your hotel,
yep,
you made, and you said it was made at a reduced scale, yeah?
Yep.
And you said it got graffiti.
Yep.
Did you find the scale shift between the graffiti and the hotel interesting?
No, it was paint bombed, so there's no... There was no text, there was no... Well, is there scale of graffiti? I suppose there is.
Well, I mean, that would have been a life scale, right?
Yeah, well, what they did was they paint bombed it. I don't know how.
Oh, okay.
So I guess they threw paint or something.
Paint,
yeah, and they haven't there was something around the back, but it was, I didn't see it. They haven't tagged it. I mean, it's quite, you know, it's alongside a freeway. You're not allowed to stop. So, you know, you get off the road on a busy freeway. It's a five lane freeway, and then it's CCTV cameras and everything. But people do stop. I mean, someone wanted to stay there. I mean, they rang the local council to stay there, you know. And, I mean, it's like, it's become a, I don't know, it's become like a... no, well, I mean, you know, there's a T-shirt in Frankston that says, I stayed at the East Link Hotel. So it's entered kind of a a sort of local folklore, if you like, which is nice, and I like it. And when they did the Santa, I'm like, you know, there is a moral thing called moral rights where you're meant to consult me about what you do, but they're like, but man, we just thought it would be great. You know, so you kind of, and you go, you hear the enthusiasm, like the teacher, and you go, well, yeah, cool, all right. I mean, I'm not gonna go, oh, fuck, that's, you can't do that to my work. You know, it's not like that. I'm not precious about those things at all. In fact, I like them being used. And the only time I'll kind of intervene is in the situation where it's just dangerous, you know. And I don't want that Richard Serra moment, you know.
It ties in with what you were saying about it perhaps being the trash of the future, did you say?
Well, I mean, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? But, you know, and people who are students of public art, you know, will, you know, in the catalogue, you know, of course there's good and bad, you know. I think we have a habit of not pushing the boundaries on what it can be, you know. You know, I got a friend of mine who did a work in Europe where they are, you know, he got awarded a commission on a hill to remove all the plants that have been imported. You know, his idea was to remove all the plants in this particular part of the world that had been imported from Brazil and take them out and take them back. You know, it's just, and that was the work, you know. Or I guess it's the great Chris Burden one where he drops the steel from the helicopter into a, you know, puddle of concrete, and wherever they fall, that's it, which is his comment on formal sculpture, I suppose. But still, they're risks. They take risks with it, you know. And we tend to just have a kind of certain variety, which is to do with, yeah, the means of production, and you know, there's that whole thing of the bigger the committee, the more mediocre the work, and I've certainly encountered that recently with something. And you know, it can really test your resolve, you know. So you need the people commissioning it to be ambitious and take risks and be good, and not too many of them, you know. And I mean, the hotel happened, it was private, you know. Essentially that road was, you know, they were linked to government, but it was a private company who did it. And the architects who were awarded are good collectors, and they, you know, asked 10 artists, and there were 4 sites and a couple of others. So, you know, they were encouraging you to take a risk. I mean, okay, risk is, you know, is popular, you know, on some levels. But anyway, not quite the risk, I think. Anyway, but I'm happy to talk about other things, but I think that's, yeah.
Did the guys that put the centre on your hotel at least get the centre to the right scale?
No, I didn't get a photo of it, but I have got a photo on my phone. But no, it's just a kind of, it was just Santa with his arm leaning down, you know, lying across the top, a cardboard cut out of it. Did they get it to the right scale? No, it was too big. It wasn't 2/3 Santa, no.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kellen. That's a fantastic talk.
Thank you.
Nice if someone over in the council buildings had a chat to you about some of the empty lots around Christchurch.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, we can hope. So please, if you haven't seen it, or indeed if you saw it just before you got here, it might be worth going back and seeing Callum's work in debuilding again. It's doing something just a little bit more than it was at that point. And
maybe give me 10 minutes just to double check.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. And in the meantime, can you thank Callum?
Cheers. Thank you.
The Wednesday, 6 o'clock. Talk on debuilding? Honestly, was Sarah who asked. I'm giving it. So.
Floor talk of the whole debuilding exhibition on Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. So you get to see Callum's work in relation to the other artists that are also included in the show. So come along to that as well.
Okay, have a good day. Thank you.
Should I just dump that?